old-fashioned in this. I like to talk to the horse's head, not the horse's ass. Do you understand me, boy?" Calder was sagging sideways, eyes red and bulging. The first of the Magi waved his hand. "You may go." The prince heaved in a ragged breath, coughed, and reeled to his feet, stumbled for his horse, and hauled himself up into the saddle with a deal less grace than he had got down. He shot a murderous glance over his shoulder as he made for the gate, but it didn't have quite the same weight with his face red as a slapped arse. Logan realized he was grinning, wide. It was a long time since he'd enjoyed himself this much. "I understand that you can speak to the spirits." Logan was caught off guard. "Eh? To speak to the spirits?" Baez shook his head. "It is a rare gift in these times. How are they?"
"What, the spirits?"
"Yes."
"Dwindling."
"Soon they will all sleep, eh? The magic leaks out of the world. That is the set order of things. Over the years, my knowledge has grown, and yet my power has diminished."
Calder seemed impressed.
"Bah!" Baez waved his hand. "A mere nothing. A little trick of air and flesh easily done. No, believe me, the magic ebbs away. It is a fact, a natural law. Still, there are many ways to crack an egg, eh, my friend? If one tool fails, then we must try another."
Logan was no longer entirely sure what they were talking about, but he was too tired to ask.
"Yes, indeed," murmured the first of the Magi. "There are many ways to crack an egg. Speaking of which, you look hungry."
Logan's mouth flooded with spit at the very mention of food.
"Yes," he mumbled. "Yes, I could eat." "Of course."
Baez clapped him warmly on the shoulder.
"And then perhaps a bath. Not that we are offended, of course, but I find that there is nothing more soothing than hot water after a long walk, and you, I suspect, have had a very long walk indeed. Come with me, Master Nine Fingers. You're safe here."
Food, bath, safety. Logan had to stop himself from weeping as he followed the old man into the library. Chapter 10. The Good Man. It was a hot, hot day outside, and the sun shone brightly through the many-paned windows, casting criss-cross patterns on the wooden floor of the audience chamber. It was mid-afternoon, and the room was soupy warm and stuffy as a kitchen. Fortis Dan Hoff, the Lord Chamberlain, was red-faced and sweaty in his fur-trimmed robes of state, and had been in an increasingly filthy mood all afternoon. Harlan Morrow, his Under-Secretary for Audiences, looked even more uncomfortable, but then he had his terror of Hoff to contend with in addition to the heat. Both men seemed greatly distressed in their own ways, but at least they got to sit down. Major West was sweating steadily into his embroidered dress uniform. He had been standing in the same position, hands behind his back, teeth gritted, for nearly 2 hours, while Lord Hoff sulked and grumbled and bellowed his way through the applicants and anyone else in view. West fervently wished, and not for the first time that afternoon, that he was lying under a tree in the park with a strong drink, or perhaps under a glacier, entombed within the ice, anywhere but here. Standing guard on these horrible audiences was hardly one of West's more pleasant duties, but it could have been worse. You had to spare a thought for the 8 soldiers stood around the walls. They were in full armor. West was waiting for one of them to pass out and crash to the floor with a sound like a cupboard full of saucepans, no doubt to the great disgust of the Lord Chamberlain, but so far they were all somehow staying upright.
"Why is this damned room always the wrong temperature?"
Hoff was demanding to know, as if the heat was an insult directed solely at him.
It's too hot half the year, too cold the other half. There's no air in here, no air at all. Why don't these windows open? Why can't we have a bigger room?
Mumbled the harassed undersecretary, pushing his spectacles up his sweaty nose.
Requests for audiences have always been held here, my Lord Chamberlain.
He paused under the fearsome gaze of his superior.
It is traditional.
I know that, you dolt,
thundered Hoff, face crimson with heat and fury.
Who asked for your damn fool of an opinion anyway?
Yes, that is to say, no, stuttered Morrow. That is to say, quite so, my lord.
Hoff shook his head with a mighty frown, staring around the room in search of something else to displease him.
How many more must we endure today?
Four more, your grace.
Damn it!
Thundered the Chamberlain, shifting in his huge chair and flapping his fur-trimmed collar to let some air in.
This is intolerable!
West found himself in silent agreement. Hoff snatched up a silver goblet from the table and took a great slurp of wine. He was a great one for drinking. Indeed, he had been drinking all afternoon. It had not improved his temper.
Who's the next fool? He demanded.
Morrow squinted at a large document through his spectacles, tracing across the crabby writing with an inky finger.
Goodman Heath is next. A farmer from...
A farmer? A farmer, did you say? So we must sit in this ridiculous heat, listening to some damn commoner moan on about how the weather has affected his sheep?
Well, my lord, muttered Morrow, it does seem as though Goodman Heath has a legitimate grievance against his landlord and...
Damn it all! I'm sick to my stomach of other people's grievances!
The Lord Chamberlain took another swallow of wine.
Show the idiot in!
The doors were opened, and Goodman Heath was allowed into their presence. To underline the balance of power within the room, the Lord Chamberlain's table was raised up on a high dais, so that even standing, the poor man had to look up at them. An honest face, but very gaunt. He held a battered hat before him in trembling hands. West shrugged his shoulders in discomfort as a drop of sweat ran down his back.
You are Goodman Heath, correct?
Yes, my lord,
mumbled the peasant in a broad accent.
From...
Hoff cut him off with consummate rudeness.
And you come before us seeking an audience with His August Majesty, the High King of the Union?
Goodman Heath licked his lips. West wondered how far he had come to be made a fool of. A very long way, most likely.
My family have been put off our land. The landlord said we had not been paying the rent, but...
The Lord Chamberlain waved a hand.
Plainly, this is a matter for the Commission for Land and Agriculture. His August Majesty the King is concerned with the welfare of all his subjects, no matter how mean.
West almost winced at this slight.
But he cannot be expected to give personal attention to every trifling thing. His time is valuable, and so is mine. Good day.
And that was it. Two of the soldiers pulled the double doors open for Goodman Heath to leave. The peasant's face had gone very pale, his knuckles ringing at the brim of his hat.
Good my lord, he stammered. I've already been to the commission.
Hoff looked up sharply, making the farmer stammer to a halt.
Good day, I said.
The peasant's shoulders slumped. He took a last look around the room. Morrow was examining something on the far wall with great interest and refused to meet his eye. The Lord Chamberlain stared back at him angrily, infuriated by this unforgivable waste of his time. West felt sick to be a part of it. Heath turned and shuffled away, head bowed. The doors swung shut. Hoff bashed his fist on the table.
Did you see that?
He stared round fiercely at the sweating assembly.
The sheer gall of the man! Did you see that, Major West?
Yes, my Lord Chamberlain, I saw it all, said West stiffly. It was a disgrace.
Fortunately, Hoff did not take his whole meaning.
A disgrace, Major West, you are quite right. Why the hell is it that all the promising young men go into the army? I want to know who is responsible for letting these beggars in here."
He glared at the Under-Secretary, who swallowed and stared at his documents.
"What's next?"
Mumbled Morrow. "Costa Dan Colt, Magister of the Guild of Mercers."
"I know who he is, dammit,"
snapped Hoff, wiping a fresh sheen of sweat from his face.
"If it isn't the damned peasants, it's the damned merchants!"
He roared at the soldiers by the door, his voice easily loud enough to be heard in the corridor outside.
"Show the grubbing old swindler in, then!"
Magister Colt could hardly have presented a more different appearance from the previous supplicant. He was a big, plump man with a face as soft as his eyes were hard. His purple vesture of office was embroidered with yards of golden thread, so ostentatious that the Emperor of Gurkle himself might have been embarrassed to wear it. He was accompanied by a pair of senior mercers, their own attire scarcely less magnificent. West wondered if Goodman Heath could earn enough in 10 years to pay for one of those gowns. He decided not, even if he hadn't been thrown off his land.
"My Lord Chamberlain,"
intoned Colt with an elaborate bow. Hoff acknowledged the head of the Guild of Mercers as faintly as humanly possible, with a raised eyebrow and an almost imperceptible twist of the lip. Colt waited for a greeting which he felt more befitting of his station, but none was forthcoming. He noisily cleared his throat.
"I have come to seek an audience with His August Majesty,"
the Lord Chamberlain snorted.
"The purpose of this session is to decide who is worthy of His Majesty's attention. If you aren't seeking an audience with him, you have blundered into the wrong room."
It was already clear that this interview would be every bit as unsuccessful as the last. There was a kind of horrible justice to it, West supposed. The great and the small were treated exactly alike. Magister Colt's eyes narrowed slightly, but he continued.
"The Honourable Guild of Mercers, of whom I am the humble representative..."
Hoff slurped wine noisily, and Colt was obliged to pause for a moment.
"Have been the victims of a most malicious and mischievous attack." "Fill this up, would you?"
yelled the Lord Chamberlain, waving his empty goblet at Morrow. The Under-Secretary slipped eagerly from his chair and seized the decanter. Colt was forced to wait, teeth gritted, while the wine gurgled out.
"Continue," blustered Hoff, waving his hand. "We don't have all day." "A most malicious and underhanded attack."
The Lord Chamberlain squinted down.
"An attack, you say? A common assault is a matter for the city watch."
Magister Colt grimaced. He and his two companions were already starting to sweat.
"Not an attack of that variety, my Lord Chamberlain, but an insidious and underhanded assault designed to discredit the shining reputation of our guild and to damage our business interests in the free cities of Styria and across the Union. An attack perpetrated by certain deceitful elements of His Majesty's Inquisition, and..."
"I have heard enough."
The Lord Chamberlain jerked up his big hand for silence.
"If this is a matter of trade, then it should be handled by His Majesty's Commission for Trade and Commerce."
Hoff spoke slowly and precisely, in the manner of a schoolmaster addressing his most disappointing pupil.
"If this is a matter of law, then it should be handled by the Department of High Justice Moravia. If it is a matter of the internal workings of His Majesty's Inquisition, then you must arrange an appointment with Archlector Salt. In any case, it is hardly a matter for the attention of His August Majesty."
The head of the Mercer's Guild opened his mouth, but the Lord Chamberlain spoke over him, voice louder than ever.
"Your king employs a commission, selects a high justice, and appoints an archlector so that he need not deal with every trifling issue himself. Incidentally, that is also why he grants licenses to certain merchant guilds and not to line the pockets,"
and his lip twisted into an unpleasant sneer,
"of the trading class. Good day."
And the doors were opened. Colt's face had turned pale with anger at that last comment.
"You may depend upon it, Lord Chamberlain," he said coldly, "that we will seek redress elsewhere, and with the very greatest of persistence."
Hoff glared back at him for a very long while.
"Seek it wherever you like," he growled, "and with as much persistence as you please, but not here. Good day."
If you could have stabbed someone in the face with the phrase "good day," the head of the Guild of Mercers would have lain dead on the floor. Colt blinked a couple of times, then turned angrily and strode out with as much dignity as he could muster. His two lackeys followed close on his heels, their fabulous gowns flapping behind them. The doors were pushed shut. Hoff smashed the table once again with his fist.
"An outrage!" he spluttered. "Those arrogant swine! Do they seriously think they can flout the king's law and still seek the king's help when things turn sour?"
"Well, no," said Morrow. "Of course..."
The Lord Chamberlain ignored his Under-Secretary and turned to West with a sneering smile.
"Still, I fancy I could see the vultures circling around them, despite the low ceiling, eh, Major West?"
"Indeed, my Lord Chamberlain,"
mumbled West, thoroughly uncomfortable and wishing this torture would end. Then he could get back to his sister. His heart sank. She was even more of a handful than he remembered. She was clever, all right, but he worried that she might be too clever for her own good. If only she would just marry some honest man and be happy. His position here was precarious enough without her making a spectacle of herself.
"Vultures, vultures," Hoff was murmuring to himself. "Nasty-looking birds, but they have their uses. What's next?"
The sweating Under-Secretary looked even more uncomfortable than before as he fumbled for the right words.
"We have a party of diplomats?"
The Lord Chamberlain paused, goblet halfway to his mouth.
"Diplomats? From whom?"
From this so-called King of the Northmen, Bethod."
Hoff burst out laughing.
"Diplomats?" he cackled, mopping his face on his sleeve. "Savages, you mean?"
The Under-Secretary chuckled unconvincingly.
"Ah, yes, my lord. Ha-ha! Savages, of course."
"But dangerous, eh, Morrow?"
snapped the Lord Chamberlain, his good humour evaporating instantly. The Under-Secretary's cackling gurgled to a halt.
"Very dangerous. We must be careful. Show them in."
There were four of them. The two smallest were great, big, fierce-looking men, scarred and bearded, clad in heavy battered armour. They had been disarmed at the gate of the Agriont, of course, but there was still a sense of danger about them, and West had the feeling they would have given up a lot of big, well-worn weapons. These were the sort of men who were crowded on the borders of Angland, hungry for war, not far from West's home. With them came an older man, also in pitted armour, and with long hair and a great white beard. There was a livid scar across his face and through his eye, which was blind white. He had a broad smile on his lips, though, and his pleasant demeanour was greatly at odds with that of his two dour companions, and with the fourth man who came behind. He had to stoop to get under the lintel, which was a good 7 feet above the floor. He was swathed and hooded in a rough brown cloak, features invisible. As he straightened up, towering over everyone else, the room began to seem absurdly cramped. His sheer bulk was intimidating. But there was something more, something that seemed to come off him in sickly waves. The soldiers around the walls felt it, and they shifted uncomfortably. The Under-Secretary for Audiences felt it, sweating and twitching and fussing with his documents. Major West certainly felt it. His skin had gone cold despite the heat, and he could feel every hair on his body standing up under his damp uniform. Only Hoff seemed unaffected. He looked the four Northmen up and down with a deep frown on his face, no more impressed with the hooded giant than he had been with Goodman Heath.
"So you are messengers from Bethot?"
He rolled the words around his mouth, then spat them out.
"The King of the Northmen."
"We are," said the smiling old man, bowing with great reverence. "I am White Eye Hansel." His voice was rich, round, and pleasant, without any accent, not at all what West had been expecting.
"And you are Bethod's emissary?"
asked Hoff casually, taking another swallow of wine from his goblet. For the first time ever, West was pleased the Lord Chamberlain was in the room with him. But then he glanced up at the hooded man, and the feeling of unease returned.
"Oh, no," said White Eye. "I am here merely as translator. This is the emissary of the King of the Northmen."
And his good eye flicked nervously up to the dark figure in the cloak, as though even he was afraid.
"Fenris."
He stretched out the S on the end of the name so that it hissed in the air.
"Fenris the Feared."
An apt name indeed. Major West thought back to songs he had heard in his childhood, stories of bloodthirsty giants in the mountains of the distant north. The room was silent for a moment. Said the Lord Chamberlain, unmoved.
"And you seek an audience with His August Majesty, the High King of the Union?"
"We do indeed, my Lord Chamberlain," said the old warrior. "Our master, Bethod, greatly regrets the hostility between our two nations. He wishes only to be on the best of terms with his southern neighbors. We bring an offer of peace from my king to yours, and a gift to show our good faith. Nothing more."
"Well, well," said Hoff, sitting back in his high chair with a broad smile.
"A gracious request, graciously made. You may see the king in open council tomorrow and present your offer, and your gift, before the foremost peers of the realm."
White Eye bowed respectfully.
"You are most kind, my Lord Chamberlain."
He turned for the door, followed by the two Dur warriors. The cloaked figure lingered for a moment, then he too slowly turned and stooped through the doorway. It wasn't until the doors were shut that West could breathe easily again. He shook his head and shrugged his sweaty shoulders. Songs about giants, indeed. A great big man in a cloak was all. But looking again, that doorway really was very high.
"There, you see, Master Morrow?"
Hoff looked intensely pleased with himself.
"Hardly the savages you led me to expect. I feel we are close to a resolution of our northern problems, don't you?"
The Under-Secretary did not look in the least convinced.
Yes, my lord, of course."
"Yes, indeed. A lot of fuss over nothing. A lot of pessimistic, defeatist nonsense from our jumpy citizens up north, eh? War? Bah!"
Hoff whacked his hand on the table again, making wine slop out of his goblet and spatter on the wood.
"These Northmen wouldn't dare. Why, next thing you know, they'll be petitioning us for membership of the Union. You see if I'm not right, eh, Major West?" Good, excellent. We've got something done today, at least. One more, and we can get out of this damn furnace. Who do we have, Morrow?"
The Under-Secretary frowned and pushed his glasses up his nose.
We have one Yoru Solfur."
He wrestled with the unfamiliar name.
"We have a who?"
"Solfia, or Sulfur, or something."
"Never heard of him," grunted the Lord Chamberlain. "What manner of a man is he? Some kind of a southerner? Not another peasant, please."
The Under-Secretary examined his notes and swallowed.
"An emissary?"
"Yes, yes, but from whom?"
Morrow was positively cringing, like a child expecting a slap.
"From the Great Order of Magi," he blurted out.
There was a moment of stunned silence. West's eyebrows went up, and his jaw came open, and he guessed that the same was happening unseen behind the visors of the soldiers. He winced instinctively as he anticipated the response of the Lord Chamberlain, but Hoff surprised them all by bursting into peals of laughter.
"Excellent! At last some entertainment! It's been years since we had a Magus here! Show in the wizard! We mustn't keep him waiting!"
Yoru Solfur was something of a disappointment. He had simple, travel-stained clothes, was scarcely better dressed than Goodman Heath had been, in fact. His staff was not shod with gold, had no lump of shining crystal on the end. His eye did not flash with a mysterious fire. He looked a fairly ordinary sort of a man in his middle 30s, slightly tired, as though after a long journey, but otherwise well at his ease before the Lord Chamberlain.
"A good day to you, gentlemen,"
he said, leaning on his staff. West was having some difficulty working out where he was from. Not the Union, because his skin was too dark, and not Gurkul, or the far south, because his skin was too light. Not from the north, or from Styria. Further, then, but where? Now that West looked at him more closely, he noticed that his eyes were different colours, one blue, one green.
"And a good day to you, sir,"
said Hoff, smiling as though he really meant it.
"My door is forever open to the great order of Magi. Tell me, do I have the pleasure of addressing great Baiaz himself?"
Sulphur looked puzzled.
"No. Was I wrongly announced? I am Yoru Solfur. Master Baiaz is a bald gentleman."
He pushed a hand through his own head of curly brown hair.
"There is a statue of him outside in the avenue. But I did have the honor to study under him for several years. He is a most powerful and knowledgeable master."
Of course he is. And how may we be of service?"
Yoru Solfur cleared his throat, as though to tell a story.
"On the death of King Harald the Great, Baiaz, the first of the Magi, left the Union, but he swore an oath to return."
"Yes, yes, that's true," chuckled Hoff. "Very true. Every schoolchild knows it."
"And he pronounced that when he returned, his coming would be heralded by another."
"True also."
"Well,"
said Solfur, smiling broadly,
"here I am."
The Lord Chamberlain roared with laughter.
"Here you are!"
he shouted, thumping the table. Harlan Morrow allowed himself a little chuckle, but shut up immediately as Hoff's smile began to fade.
"During my tenure as Lord Chamberlain, I have had three members of the Great Order of Magi apply to me for audiences with the King. Two were most clearly insane, and one was an exceptionally courageous swindler."
He leaned forward, placing his elbows on the table and steepling his fingers before him.
"Tell me, Master Solfur, which kind of Magus are you?"
"I am neither of those."
"I see. Then you will have documents?"
"Of course."
Solfur reached into his coat and brought out a small letter, closed with a white seal, a single strange symbol stamped into it. He placed it carelessly on the table before the Lord Chamberlain. Hoff frowned. He picked up the document and turned it over in his hands. He examined the seal carefully. Then he dabbed his face with his sleeve, broke the wax, unfolded the thick paper, and began to read. Yoru Solfur showed no sign of nerves. He didn't appear troubled by the heat. He strolled around the room, he nodded to the armored soldiers, he didn't seem upset by their lack of response. He turned suddenly to West.
"It's terribly hot in here, isn't it? It's a wonder these poor fellows don't pass out and crash to the floor with a sound like a cupboard full of saucepans."
West blinked. He had been thinking the very same thing. The Lord Chamberlain put the letter down carefully on the table, no longer in the least amused.
"It occurs to me that the Open Council would be the wrong place to discuss this matter."
"I agree.
I was hoping for a private audience with Lord Chancellor Fichte.
I am afraid that will not be possible.
Hoff licked his lips.
Lord Fichte is dead.
Sulphur frowned.
That is most unfortunate.
Indeed, indeed, we all feel his loss most keenly. Perhaps I and certain other members of the Closed Council can assist you.
Sulphur bowed his head.
I am guided by you, my Lord Chamberlain.
I will try to arrange something for later this evening. Until then, we will find you some lodgings within the Agriant, suitable for your station.
He signalled to the guards, and the doors were opened.
Thank you so much, Lord Hoff. Master Morrow, Major West.
Sulphur nodded to them graciously, each in turn, and then turned and left. The doors were closed once more, leaving West wondering how the man had known his name. Hoff turned to his Under-Secretary for Audiences.
Go immediately to Archlector Salt and tell him we must meet at once. Then fetch High Justice Morovia and Lord Marshal Varus. Tell them it is a matter of the very highest importance, and not a word of this to anyone beyond those three.
He shook his finger in Morrow's sweaty face.
Not a word.
The Under-Secretary stared back, spectacles askew.
Now!
Roared Hoff. Morrow leapt to his feet, stumbled on the hem of his gown, then hurried out through a side door. West swallowed, his mouth very dry. Hoff stared long and hard at each man in the room.
As for the rest of you, not a word to anyone about any of this, or the consequences for all of you will be most severe. Now out! Everyone out!
The soldiers clanked from the room immediately. West needed no further encouragement, and he hurried after them, leaving the brooding Lord Chamberlain alone in his high chair. West's thoughts were dark and confused as he pulled the door shut behind him. Fragments of old stories of the Magi, fears about war in the north, images of a hooded giant towering up near the ceiling. There had been some strange and some sinister visitors to the Agriant that day, and he felt quite weighed down by worries. He tried to shrug them off, told himself it was all foolishness, but then all he could think of was his sister, cavorting about the Agriant like a fool. He groaned to himself. She was probably with Luthar right now. Why the hell had he introduced the two of them? For some reason, he had been expecting the same awkward, sickly, sharp-tongued girl he remembered from years ago. He had got quite a shock when this woman had turned up at his quarters. He had barely recognized her. Undoubtedly a woman. And a fine-looking one, too. Meanwhile, Luthar was arrogant and rich and handsome and had all the self-restraint of a six-year-old. He knew they had seen each other since, and more than once. Just as friends, of course. Adi had no other friends here. Just friends.
Shit, he cursed.
It was like putting a cat by the cream and trusting it not to stick its tongue in. Why the hell hadn't he thought it through? It was a damn disaster in the making. But what could he do about it now? He stared off miserably down the hallway. There's nothing like seeing another's misery to make you forget your own, and Goodman Heath was a sorry sight indeed. He was sitting alone on a long bench, face deathly pale, staring off into space. He must have been sitting there all this time, while the Mercers and the Northmen and the Magus came and went, waiting for nothing but with nowhere left to go. West glanced up and down the hallway. There was no one else nearby. Heath was oblivious to him, mouth open, eyes glassy, battered hat forgotten on his knees. West couldn't simply leave the man like this. He didn't have it in him.
Goodman Heath, he said as he approached, and the peasant looked up at him, surprised.
He fumbled for his hat and made to rise, muttering apologies.
No, please, don't get up.
West sat down on the bench. He stared at his feet, unable to look the man in the eye. There was an awkward silence.
I have a friend who sits on the Commission for Land and Agriculture. There might be something he can do for you.
He trailed off, embarrassed, squinting up the corridor. The farmer gave a sad smile.
I'd be right grateful for anything you could do.
Yes, yes, of course. I'll do what I can. It would do no good whatsoever, and they both knew it. West grimaced and bit his lip.
You'd better take this.
And he pressed his purse into the peasant's limp, calloused fingers. Heath looked at him, mouth slightly open. West gave a quick, awkward smile, then got to his feet. He was very keen to be off.
Sir,
called Goodman Heath after him, but West was already hurrying down the corridor, and he didn't look back.
Chapter 11. On the List.
Why do I do this?
The outline of Willem Dan Rob's townhouse was cut out in black against the clear night sky. It was an unremarkable building, a two-story dwelling with a low wall and a gate in front, just like 100 others in this street.
Our old friend Ruse used to live in a palatial great villa near the market. Rob really should have asked him for some more ambitious bribes. Still, lucky for us, he didn't.
Elsewhere in the city, the fashionable avenues would be brightly lit and busy with drunken revelers right through until dawn. But this secluded side street was far from the bright lights and the prying eyes. We can work undisturbed. Round the side of the building, on the upper floor, a lamp was burning in a narrow window.
Good. Our friend is at home, but still awake. We must tread gently.
He turned to Practical Frost and pointed down the side of the house. The albino nodded and slipped away silently across the street. Glockter waited for him to reach the wall and disappear into the shadows beside the building. Then he turned to Severard and pointed at the front door. The eyes of the lanky Practical smiled at him for a moment, then he scuttled quickly away, staying low, rolled over the low wall, and dropped without a sound onto the other side.
Perfect so far, but now I must move.
Glockter wondered why he had come. Frost and Severard were more than capable of dealing with Rob by themselves, and he would only slow them down.
I might even fall on my arse and alert the idiot to our presence, so why did I come?
But Glockter knew why. The feeling of excitement was already building in his throat. It felt almost like being alive. He had muffled the end of his cane with a bit of rag, so he was able to limp to the wall ever so delicately, without making too much noise. By that time, Severard had swung the gate open, holding the hinge with one gloved hand so that it didn't make a noise.
Nice and neat. That little wall might as well be 100 feet high for all my chances of getting over it.
Severard was kneeling on the step against the front door, picking the lock. His ear was close to the wood, his eyes squinting with concentration, gloved hands moving deftly. Glockter's heart was beating fast, his skin prickly with tension.
Ah, the thrill of the hunt.
There was a soft click, then another. Severard slipped his glittering picks into a pocket, then reached out and slowly, carefully turned the doorknob. The door swung silently open.
What a useful fellow he is. Without him and Frost, I am just a cripple. They are my hands, my arms, my legs. But I am their brains.
Severard slipped inside and Glockter followed him, wincing with pain every time he put his weight on his left leg. The hallway was dark, but there was a shaft of light spilling down the stairs from above, and the banisters cast strange, distorted shadows on the wooden floor. Glockter pointed up the steps, and Severard nodded and began to tiptoe toward them, keeping his feet close to the wall. It seemed to take him an age to get there. The third step made a quiet creaking sound as he put his weight on it. Glockter winced. Severard froze in place. They waited, still as statues. There was no sound from upstairs. Glockter began to breathe again. Severard moved ever so slowly upwards, step by gentle step. As he got towards the top, he peered cautiously round the corner, back pressed against the wall. Then he took the last step and disappeared from view without a sound. Practical Frost emerged from the shadows at the far end of the corridor. Glockter raised an eyebrow at him, but he shook his head. Nobody downstairs. He turned to the front door and started to close it ever so gently. Only when it was shut did he slowly, slowly release the doorknob so the latch slid silently into place. "You'll want to see this." Glockter gave a start at the sudden sound, turning round quickly and causing a jolt of pain to shoot through his back. Severard was standing, hands on hips, at the head of the stairs. He turned and made off towards the light, and Frost bounded up the steps after him, no longer making any pretense at stealth. Why can no one ever stay on the ground floor? Always upstairs. At least he didn't have to try to be quiet as he struggled up the steps after his practicals, right foot creaking, left foot scraping on the boards. Bright lamplight was flooding out into the upstairs corridor from an open door at the far end, and Glockter limped toward it. He paused as he crossed the threshold, catching his breath after the climb. Oh, dear me, what a mess. A big bookcase had been torn away from the wall, and books were scattered, open and closed, all about the floor. A glass of wine had been knocked over on the desk, making sodden red rags of the crumpled papers strewn across it. The bed was in disarray, the covers pulled half off, the pillows and the mattress slashed and spilling feathers. A wardrobe had its doors open, one of them dangling half off. A few tattered garments were hanging inside, but most were lying torn in a heap below. A handsome young man lay on his back under the window, staring up, pale-faced and open-mouthed at the ceiling. It would have been an understatement to say that his throat had been cut. It had been hacked so savagely that his head was only just still attached. There was blood splattered everywhere, on the torn clothes, on the slashed mattress, all over the body itself. There were a couple of smeared, bloody palm prints on the wall, a great pool of blood across a good part of the floor, still wet. He was killed tonight, perhaps only a few hours ago, perhaps only a few minutes. "I don't think he'll be answering our questions," said Severard. "No." Glockter's eyes drifted over the wreckage. "I think he might be dead. But how did it happen?" Frost fixed him with a pink eye and raised a white eyebrow.
"Poison?"
Severard spluttered with shrill laughter under his mask. Even Glockter allowed himself a chuckle.
"Clearly. But how did our poison get in?"
"Open window,"
mumbled Frost, pointing at the floor. Glockter limped into the room, careful not to let his feet or his cane touch the sticky mess of blood and feathers.
"So, our poison saw the lamp burning, just as we did. He entered via the downstairs window. He climbed silently up the stairs."
Glockter turned the corpse's hands over with the tip of his cane. A few specks of blood from the neck, but no damage to the knuckles or the fingers. He did not struggle. He was taken by surprise. He craned forward and peered at the gaping wound.
"A single powerful cut, probably with a knife."
"And Willem den Robbers sprung a most serious leak," said Severard.
"And we are short one informant," mused Glockter.
There had been no blood in the corridor.
"Our man took pains not to get his feet wet while searching the room, however messy it may look. He was not angry or afraid. It was just a job." "The killer was a professional," murmured Glockter. "He came here with murder in mind. Then perhaps he made this little effort to give the appearance of a burglary. Who can say? Either way, the Archlector won't be satisfied with a corpse."
He looked up at his two practicals.
"Who's next on the list?"
This time there had been a struggle without a doubt,
if a one-sided one.
Solimo Scandi was sprawled on his side, facing the wall, as though embarrassed by the state of his slashed and tattered nightshirt. There were deep cuts in his forearms, where he struggled vainly to ward off the blade. He had crawled across the floor, leaving a bloody trail across the highly polished wood, where he struggled vainly to get away. He had failed. The four gaping knife wounds in his back had been the end of him. Glockter felt his face twitching as he looked down at the bloody corpse. One body might just be a coincidence. Two make a conspiracy. His eyelid fluttered. Whoever did this knew we were coming, and when, and precisely who for. They are one step ahead of us. More than likely, our list of accomplices has already become a list of corpses. There was a creaking sound behind Glockter, and his head whipped round, sending shooting pains down his stiff neck. Nothing but the open window swinging in the breeze. Calm now. Calm and think it out. It would seem the Honourable Guild of Murthers have been doing a little housekeeping. How could they know? Muttered Severard. How indeed. They must have seen Ruth's list, or been told who was on it. And that means... Glockter licked at his empty gums. Someone inside the Inquisition has been talking. For once, Severard's eyes were not smiling. If they know who's on the list, they know who wrote it. They know who we are. Three more names on the list, perhaps, down at the bottom. Glockter grinned. How very exciting. You scared? I'm not happy, I'll tell you that. He nodded down at the corpse. A knife in the back isn't part of my plan. Nor mine, Severard. Believe me. No, indeed. If I die, I'll never know who betrayed us. And I want to know. A bright, cloudless spring day, and the park was busy with fops and idlers of every variety. Glockter sat very still on his bench, in the merciful shade of a spreading tree, and stared out at the shimmering greenery, the sparkling water, the happy, the drunken, the colourful revellers. There were people wedged together on the benches around the lake, pairs and groups scattered around the grass, drinking and talking and basking in the sun. There seemed no space for any more. But no one came and sat next to Glockter. Occasionally somebody would hurry up, hardly able to believe their luck in finding such a spot. Then they would see him sitting there. Their faces would fall, and they would swerve away or walk right past as though they had never meant to sit. I drive them away as surely as the plague, but perhaps that's just as well. I don't need their company. He watched a group of young soldiers rowing a boat on the lake. One of them stood up, wobbling around, holding forth with a bottle in his hand. The boat rocked alarmingly, and his companions shouted at him to get down. Vague gales of good-natured laughter came wafting through the air, delayed a little by the distance. Children, how young they look, how innocent. And such was I not long ago. It seems 1,000 years, though. Longer. It seems a different world.
Glockter!
He looked up, shading his eyes with his hand. It was Archlector Salt, arrived at last, a tall, dark shape against the blue sky. Glockter thought he looked a little more tired, more lined, more drawn than usual as he stared coldly down.
This had better be interesting.
Salt flicked out the tails of his long white coat and lowered himself gracefully onto the bench.
The commoners are up in arms again near Kelne. Some idiot of a landowner hangs a few peasants, and now we have a mess to deal with. How hard can it be to manage a field full of dirt and a couple of farmers? You don't have to treat them well, just as long as you don't hang them.
His mouth was a straight, hard line as he glared out across the lawns.
This had better be damned interesting.
Then I'll try not to disappoint you. Willem Dan Rob is dead. As though to add emphasis to Glockter's statement, the drunken soldier slipped and toppled over the side of the boat, splashing into the water.
His friend's screams of laughter reached Glockter a moment later.
He was murdered.
Ha! It happens. Pick up the next man on the list.
Salt got to his feet, frowning.
I didn't think you'd need my approval for every little thing. That's why I picked you for this job. Just get on with it,
he snapped as he turned away. There's no need to rush, Archlector. That's the trouble with good legs. You tend to run around too much. If you have trouble moving, on the other hand, you don't move until you damn well know it's time. The next man on the list also suffered a mishap. Salt turned back, one eyebrow slightly raised.
He did?
They all did. The Archlector pursed his lips, sat back down on the bench.
All of them?
All of them.
Hmm, mused Salt. That is interesting. The Mercers are cleaning up, are they? I hardly expected such ruthlessness. Times have changed, all right. Times have certainly...
He trailed off, slowly starting to frown.
You think someone gave them Rue's list, don't you? You think one of ours has been talking? That's why you asked me to come here, isn't it?
Did you think I was just avoiding the stairs? Each one of them killed? Each and every name on our list? The very night we go to arrest them? I am not a great believer in coincidences. Are you, Archlector? He was evidently not. His face had turned very grim.
Who saw the confession?
Me and my two practicals, of course.
You have absolute confidence in them?
Absolute. There was a pause. The boat was drifting, rudderless, as the soldiers scrambled about, oars sticking up in the air, the man in the water splashing and laughing, spraying water over his friends.
The confession was in my office for some time, murmured the Archlector. Some members of my staff could have seen it. Could have.
You have absolute confidence in them, Your Eminence? Salt stared at Glockter for a long, icy moment.
They wouldn't dare. They know me better than that.
That leaves Superior Kaline, said Glockter quietly. The Archlector's lips hardly moved as he spoke.
You must tread carefully, Inquisitor, very carefully. The ground is not at all safe where you are walking. Fools do not become superiors of the Inquisition, despite appearances. Kaline has many friends, both within the House of Questions and outside it. Powerful friends. Any accusation against him must be backed up by the very strongest of proof.
Salt stopped suddenly, waiting for a small group of ladies to pass out of earshot.
The very strongest of proof, he hissed, once they had moved away. You must find me this assassin.
Easier said than done. Of course, Your Eminence, but my investigation hath reached something of a dead end.
Not quite. We still have one card left to play. Ruse himself.
Ruse. But, Archlector, he will be in Angland by now. Sweating down a mine or some such, if he has even lasted this long.
No, he is here in the Agriont under lock and key. I thought it best to hold on to him.
Glockter did his utmost to contain his surprise. Clever, very clever. Fools do not become Archlectors either, it seems.
Ruse will be your bait. I will have my secretary carry a message to Kaline, letting him know that I have relented, that I am prepared to let the Mercers continue to operate, but under tighter control, that as a gesture of goodwill, I have let Ruse go. If Kaline is the source of our leak, I dare say he will let the Mercers know that Ruse is free. I dare say they will send this assassin to punish him for his loose tongue. I dare say... you could take him while he is trying. If the killer doesn't come, well, we might have to look for our traitor elsewhere, and we have lost nothing.
An excellent plan, Your Eminence. Salt stared at him coldly.
Of course, You will need somewhere to operate, somewhere far from the House of Questions. I will make the funds available, have ruse delivered to your practicals, and let you know when Kaline has the information. Find me this assassin, Glockter, and squeeze him. Squeeze him until the pips squeak.
The boat lurched wildly as the soldiers tried to haul their wet companion in. Then it suddenly turned right over, dumping them all into the water.
I want names, hissed Salt, glowering at the splashing soldiers. I want names and evidence and documents and people who will stand up in open council and point fingers.
He stood up smoothly from the bench.
Keep me informed.
He strode off towards the House of Questions, feet crunching on the gravel of the path, and Glockter watched him go. An excellent plan. I'm glad you're on my side, Archlector. You are on my side, aren't you? The soldiers had succeeded in hauling the upended boat onto the bank and were standing, dripping wet, shouting at one another, no longer so good-humoured. One of the oars was still floating, abandoned in the water, drifting gradually towards the point where the stream flowed from the lake. Soon it would pass under the bridge and be carried out beneath the great walls of the Agriant and into the moat. Glockter watched it turning slowly round in the water. A mistake. One should attend to the details. It is easy to forget the little things, but without the oar, the boat is useless. He let his gaze wander across some of the other faces in the park. His eye alighted on a handsome pair sitting on a bench by the lake. The young man was speaking quietly to the girl, a sad and earnest expression on his face. She got up quickly, moving away from him with her hands over her face. Ah, the pain of the jilted lover, the loss, the anger, the shame. It seems as though you'll never recover. What poet was it who wrote, "There's no pain worse than the pain of a broken heart"? Sentimental shit. He should have spent more time in the Emperor's prisons. He smiled, opening his mouth and licking the empty gums where his front teeth used to be. Broken hearts heal with time, but broken teeth never do. Glockter looked at the young man. He had an expression of slight amusement on his face as he watched the weeping girl walk away. The young bastard. I wonder if he's broken as many hearts as I did in my youth. It hardly seems possible now. It takes me half an hour just to pluck up the courage to stand. The only women I've made cry lately have been the wives of those I've had exiled to Angland.
Send!
Glockter turned around.
Lord Marshal Verruth, what an honour. Oh, no, no, said the old soldier, sitting down on the bench with the swift, precise movements of the fencing master. You look well, he said, but without really looking.
I look crippled, you mean.
How are you, my old friend?
I'm crippled, you pompous old ass. And friend, is it? All those years since I came back, and you have never sought me out, not once. Is that a friendship?
Well enough, thank you, Lord Marshal.
Verruz shifted uncomfortably on the bench.
My latest student, Captain Luthar, perhaps you know him?
We are acquainted.
You should see his forms.
Verruz shook his head sadly.
He has the talent, all right, though he will never be in your class, Sand.
I don't know. I hope someday he'll be just as crippled as I am.
But he has plenty of talent, enough to win. Only he's wasting it, throwing it away.
Oh, the tragedy of it. I am so upset I could be sick. Had I eaten anything this morning?
He is lazy, Sand, and stubborn. He lacks courage. He lacks dedication. His heart is just not in it, and time is running out. I was wondering, if you have the time, of course.
Verruz looked Glockter in the eye for just an instant.
Whether you might be able to speak to him for me.
I can hardly wait. Lecturing that whining ass would be the realization of all my dreams.
You arrogant old dolt, how dare you? You built your reputation on my successes, then when I needed your help you cut me off.
And now you come to me and seek my help and call me friend?
Of course, Marshal Varuth. I would be glad to speak to him. Anything for an old friend.
Excellent, excellent. I'm sure you'll make all the difference. I train him every morning in that courtyard near the house.